The deadliest cancers don't just grow rapidly, they defend. They build barriers, shield themselves from attack, and adapt faster than our ability to stop them. For years, even the most advanced immunotherapies struggled to break through. But what if immune cells could think for themselves? What if we could program them to navigate the body more precisely, adapt to changing threats, and strategize like a fighter who refuses to lose? That's the vision driving Cole Roybal, PhD, director of the Pisces Center at UCSF. Dr. Roybal is redefining what cell therapy can be, giving T-cells the ability to make decisions in real time, recognize cancer's defense mechanisms, and outsmart them. Like an artist at the edge of discovery, he is pushing the boundaries of what's possible, rewriting the rules, and creating something entirely new to give patients more time, more options, and a chance at a future beyond this disease. At the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, we bring together the brightest minds, break down barriers between research and clinical application, and push breakthroughs faster from bench to bedside. Today, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer Dr. John Connolly sits down with Dr. Roybal to talk about the future of cell therapy, the power of synthetic biology, and how engineering the immune system could change everything. I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran, Pisces Senior Vice President of Strategy and Operations. Welcome to From Bench to Fireside.
Welcome to From Bench to Fireside from the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. I'm John Connolly, Chief Scientific Officer at PICE. Today I'm joined by Dr. Cole Roybal, who became the director for the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy Center at UCSF in 2003. Cole is creating what many call living drugs. These are immune cells that are specifically engineered to hunt down cancer and eliminate it with remarkable precision and generating long-term durable anti-cancer responses. Now, what makes Cole's work so fascinating is he's reimagining what immune cells can do. Think of it like teaching an old dog new tricks, engineering the cells to actually hunt cancer, and then once they get there, eliminate that cancer and persistently evolve alongside the body to make sure that it doesn't come back. So with that, I just want to say, Cole, welcome. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, John. I mean, it's really a pleasure to take part in this podcast. As you know, I've worked with Pisces since the beginning of my independent career, and it's one of the most important networks that I'm involved in. And I owe Pisces a lot for my career at this point. So I look forward to discussing our work and the Pisces network.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Cole. I think that the work that you're doing, really pioneering synthetic biology at the level of these immune cells and really pushing it into the clinic as well, taking completely different approaches, is really, really fantastic. And it's fundamentally different than a lot of the immunologists that are out there. You know, most immunologists and scientists spend their career trying to understand how the immune system naturally works. But you've taken a different path, really. You're actually trying to push the boundaries and ask, what is the limit that the immune system can actually do, by engineering these? So what sparked this idea? What got you into synthetic biology?
I started as a basic immunologist, someone studying immune cells, especially T cells that are important for almost any infection you have, and then obviously important for eliminating cancer. So it started there. I think you need to understand natural systems before you can manipulate it.
Sure.
And I think I was in the right place in the right time. I was transitioning to my postdoc, and Wendell Lim here at UCSF, who is a pioneer in synthetic biology. But if you look at the history of synthetic biology, it was in bacteria. It was in yeast. It turns out technology development allows it to be tractable to modify and re-engineer immune cells. And the other piece of this is that, to me, synthetic biology is a bit of a rebranding. Like, people were modifying T cells with things like the early instantiation of chimeric antigen receptors in the late 1980s and 90s, right?
Right.
And that's the other piece. I was coming into my postdoc and then getting into engineering at a time in which we can iterate faster, we can manipulate the genome, we can synthesize genes with DNA. And then I think combining the knowledge of like how cells work, like T cells, and then having all those tools to now manipulate them allowed us to do this at scale and really sort of this, drive the burgeoning of synthetic biology in the immune system. So it's not that it was a new idea. I think it's just the right time in order to really scale it and do something new that could really be impactful in cancer.
Yeah, I think that the engineering of the cells may not have been new, but I think you guys did take it to the next level with these synthetic circuits, you know, these feedback loops that really they mimic a lot of the natural biology that's out there. You know, some of the gating strategies you and Wendell and others have really pushed forward are making a huge difference in when we think of synthetic immunology and many of the modern cell therapies that are out there. So what kind of led you to doing that?
The way I think about it, and still I think about it to date, is that we wouldn't have these diseases if our immune system evolved to be able to eradicate them. And as we've lived longer, we have diseases like cancer that are more rampant, and we need to be able to improve our immune cells to do that. So if the natural immune system isn't good enough, that means that we have to use these tools to modify the cells and see if we can push them past our limits. And then if you say that's the problem, so that's the why, it's like, well, what tools do you need? And I think what we've been really good at is identifying new technologies to allow cells to more precisely recognize disease. And not only that, but if once they recognize the disease, what are they going to do therapeutically? We need them to be there. We need them to persist, to activate in a very difficult environment like a tumor. And then not only that, have the ability to program capabilities that are beyond what's natural, because cancer really isn't natural. That's an evolutionary process where those cells in your body have become extremely potent in a way that ends up killing you. And you need something equally potent that goes beyond nature.
You know, building upon that, you really developed a few different technologies in the past few years, you know, really working closely on the SYN-Notch system, which is out there, but also the sniper receptors that you've got in the lab you recently came with. Could you talk a little bit about how each of those works, explained for those that aren't synthetic biologists out there, how those function?
I mean, when we came into developing these new receptor types, and we have various receptors that existed for T cell therapies, things like chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapies. And the reason I bring those up is I just want to contrast how they work with snipers and SYN-Notch, right? So you put in these, what are effectively synthetic T cell receptors like CARs or chimeric antigen receptors. And what happens is they can recognize a tumor, something on the surface of the tumor, and they activate the T cell. But the T cell has essentially, when it's activated, its natural functionality.
Yeah.
Now, if you look at SYN-Notch or the sniper receptors, what they allow for is we can now program a cell to recognize something on the tumor. But when these receptors are activated, they can actually initiate a gene program in the cell that is completely customizable. Meaning, like, we can build a cell that senses a tumor, and then once it senses the tumor, it can turn on the production and secretion of therapeutics to elicit immunity in the tumor. We can pair the snipers or the SYN-Notches with CARs to do what we call two-factor identification of tumors so they can better recognize the disease. And that's a big issue, right? There's very few options for going after single targets on tumors. So if we can layer these receptor technologies together, we can get better precision, potentially better efficacy, and then also safety, right? So these new receptor types solve a different problem than what existed before. And not only that, they're extremely versatile. So they work in macrophages and NK cells, T cells, a variety of different receptor types. So I think that's why it's excited people, and they're used in many different labs and now clinically. Yeah.
That's great. So taking a step back to kind of framing the problem, you mentioned that there are very few single targets on tumors. And so you coming up with combinatorial kind of approaches like the SYN-Notch sniper system, it seems really essential to not just enhancing efficacy, but, you know, the other part is limiting toxicity. Is that something you guys have worked on as well, trying to limit the toxicity associated with many of these cell therapies being much more precise?
That's been probably a decade journey, sort of going from initial prototypes of these receptor systems and circuits to what is being clinically used. And at this point, we can utilize snipers or SYN-Notches in combination with CARs to go after clinical targets like ovarian cancer, renal cancer, prostate cancer in the future. These sort of receptors are being used in glioblastoma. Trials are ongoing now. So it's going from, okay, what does it look like? Conceptually, we can build them. They work as advertised in preclinical models. And then we've gone on this journey and said, well, what targets should we go after with these specific receptor systems? Mm-hmm. And now there's clinical products. That's something I'm extremely passionate about. Like, it's one thing as a scientist to sort of put out these new technologies and show people what's possible. It's another thing to make sure to shepherd them to the place where they can make impact. That's something that the PiSE network helps with as well, and in various ways that we can talk about as well.
Yeah, that's really at the heart of what we do at PiSE, is really linking up fantastic synthetic biologists like yourself, fundamental immunologists, and moving that into translational immunology and then right into the clinic. And so when we think about the cancer immunotherapy that's out there now, you know, particularly like systemic therapies, things like chemotherapy or even systemic immunotherapy, you know, we think of these as like a hammer, just hitting that tumor and really trying to take it out. When you think about the work that you're doing, what's the metaphor there that you're thinking about when you approach this?
In some ways, I don't think about us as building tools like hammers. Like, what do cells allow for? In some ways, if that hammer is given to the right individual, like an artisan, right, that can be a powerful tool, right? But just the hammer does nothing.
Sure.
So what we work on is essentially building cells that can actually deliver therapeutics in a way that they can be both safe, precise, and effective, right? And when we go back to the discussion about snipers and SynNotch, mm-hmm. in some ways we're building cells that are almost like Swiss Army knives.
Sure.
Where we can program in different functionality. And the desire is to have a cell that can switch on different therapeutic programs and aspects depending on the context of the disease. So it's all about versatility. How can you program a cell to, once it is in the tumor microenvironment, it can make decisions on what is the right therapeutic action. So that's the vision of the future. And I think that's very different than just providing a biologic or a small molecule IV to a patient. You have a cell that is able to make decisions about disease and is able to evolve with the disease in order to eradicate it in a way that is multifaceted mm-hmm. rather than singular in focus, which is harder to circumvent.
Oh yeah, much. Yeah, that's incredible. So I think that the approach that you're taking, you know, this idea that you're really putting the program into the cell and it decides once it hits that microenvironment, the tumor, how to react. You mentioned that this also is very versatile, these technologies. They can work in multiple cell types. The immune system, of course, is a kind of a dynamic, complex system of multiple cells in constant communication with each other. Have you thought about actually modifying multiple cell types? I know it may be still in the laboratory phase, but would that be something that that you guys are looking at and taking forward?
Absolutely. We have ongoing work. And I guess what I would say first is that this is also a case that this is how our natural immune system works. And the reason why it's so powerful is collaboration. If you're virally infected, you're going to have a range of cells that come together to prevent that virus from spreading and to eradicate it from the body. So sure. Why wouldn't we do that with the future of cell therapy? And it's another concept of distributed labor, right? Certain immune cell types are good at one task. Other ones are good at others. Can we program them to work together in order to eliminate diseases like cancer, which are extremely good at circumventing the immune response, right? So one problem with cancer is it evolves so rapidly that people relapse because those therapies are no longer viable because the cancer is no longer susceptible to them. And if you have multiple cell types that are able to come together to sort of bring different therapeutic actions, you have a better chance of that tumor not escaping.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think some of our listeners now are hearing about this synthetic biology, incredibly interested in the tools that went into creating it and the direction it's going. I should say that, you know, it's not just work that's being done in the laboratory and in model systems. This have obviously moved into the clinic, and you've been extremely entrepreneurial in your career, Cole, and Arsenal Bio is one of the most exciting startups in biotech that you've been a co-founder of and moved some of this technology out into it. So at Paisu, we're proud of this unique model of taking the discoveries and making sure that they get into patients, and these biotechs are ways to actually do that. Can you share how Paisu brought together the founding team of Arsenal Bio and transformed your individual discoveries into something that coalesced into the company?
Yeah. I mean, this is a core mission of Paisu, right? It's like, let's not leave technologies at the early stage. Like, how do we get the right team together to take them to the clinic and make impact?
Yeah.
So the talent for cancer immunotherapy exists across the network, right? There's a lot of aggregation in the Bay Area, but not everyone's here, right? And what happens within the Paisu network is we have retreats. We bring together the best people across the other institutions like UPenn or the Broad Institute, which another founder was from there, Brad Bernstein. But Paisu brings us together. We have different technologies. We understand in the cell therapy space, and it's probably clear from this conversation, cell therapies are much more complicated than a small molecule or a biologic, which is easier to manufacture, easier to produce. We have a lot more knowledge of it. And what goes into building what are hopefully blockbuster cell therapies is a lot of different technologies and expertise.
Yeah.
So someone like Alex Marson here, who leads the Gladstone Paisu mm-hmm. Institute, had technology that allows us to insert genes into the genome with CRISPR. Mm-hmm. And then for me, we've talked about the technologies that we sort of brought to the table. It's the receptors that allow those cells to now sense tumors in a more precise way and hopefully sort of balance this equation of efficacy and toxicity because you have better precision on the tumor, also a more potent cell product. And then people like John Weary at Penn have a ton of expertise over now decades to understand T-cell biology. So what knobs do we need to turn in the T-cell to improve their potency, et cetera? And it's that sort of set of folks being put in a room at a retreat and over time that hash out, what does that target product profile look like for that
right.
first product, in a company? And then once you have the idea that you have all the right pieces, you start to be able to recruit all the incredible people that end up forming the foundation of that company. So you're able to get the investment, and Paisu helps with that sort of aspect of the journey, the right sort of leadership that's going to be able to take you through like the ups and downs of building most complex therapies. Some of my best colleagues say it's 7 to 10 years to do anything interesting in this sort of space, really
right.
take it to full value inflection. And you have to find the right people to go on that journey. And this network is built with a lot of people that have knowledge of how to do that and then put the right pieces together to have the best shots on goal, I would say, to making therapies that can be truly transformative for patients. And that's what gets me up every morning. Like I we'll probably talk about this, but it's something that I want to do over and over again.
So, Cole, beyond Arsenal Bio, you've helped launch several other ventures, including Moonlight Bio, which takes the fascinating approach of learning from the cancer's own mutations to make a much more effective therapy. So what's the connection between, between the cancer observations and the technology you put into Moonlight?
Yeah. So Moonlight's a more recent company, is about 2 years old, and it's based on some work that I did with my collaborator, Jay Choi, who's at Northwestern, who studies T-cell malignancies. Mm-hmm. I think from first principles, you can simply ask, where do you find extraordinary T-cells?
Right.
Malignant T-cells are actually extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean, the numbers are like 1 in 3 billion or so T-cells in your body. One of them has to collect a certain set of mutations to proliferate uncontrollably, to persist, to actually resist immune suppression and become like the dominant T cell in the body. So another part of this sort of thesis is that it's actually quite hard to transform T cells. If you look across different cell types, like T cells need to accumulate multiple mutations in order to become malignant. So what that sort of led us to think is that, well, we can catalog all the different mutant genes that seem to be associated with T-cell malignancies,
yeah.
but potentially not like a single mutation is not going to be something that transforms the T cell, but it could reshape T cell biology in a very potent way. Mm-hmm. So we thought studying these mutations in the context of T cell therapies could be a place where we could have really outsized impact, meaning that we could find mutations that really improve T cell function without turning that T cell into a cancer. And that thesis has proven to be true. And really, the papers that we put out just recently are really the tip of the iceberg. We continue to do this work and are finding additional sort of mutations from these malignancies that could be transformative for building better T cell therapies. So we found one of the top things that we found was a fusion protein, and it was found in one patient. Mm-hmm. And this fusion protein, which, you know, in malignancies, you can have two genes on a chromosome that end up being linked together because of chromosome instability. And we ported that fusion protein in different types of T cell therapies,
sure.
TCRTs, CAR Ts, et cetera.
Right.
And we saw extraordinary functionality. And to the point where it fixed a lot of, at least preclinically, it seemingly can fix a lot of the issues we see with cell therapy. These T cells can now function in a very cold, immunologically cold tumor settings. We can treat with extremely low doses of T cells, which goes to like the difficulty of manufacturing cell therapy.
Right.
We can potentially relieve the requirement of things like toxic preconditioning of the patients.
That's amazing.
So we wanted to sort of move forward and say, like, this is compelling and not preclinical data. We want to make clinical products and do it as quickly as possible. So we built out a team and a company around it, and we'll have our first product in patients by next year. That's really about 2.5 to 3 years that we go from initial work to clinical translation, which I think is really exciting.
It's amazing advances you just mentioned there, not just this idea of long-term persistence of those T cells and their ability to constantly fight the tumor and to work in the microenvironment, but getting rid of that toxic preconditioning. And this is a huge, huge barrier for cell therapy that's out there. So, you know, really excited to see the data from that clinical trial from the company. It's going to be great.
Yeah.
And so this idea of moving things from the lab and into companies in order to execute into the clinic, you know, under project management, you know, with professional teams that can really take things forward. This is something you've also done with Dispatch Therapeutics as well. Could you, this is a little bit of a different approach, but again, synthetic biology paired now with other technology. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. What are the major problems we want to solve in cell therapy in the sense that, you know, arsenal, precision targeting with multi-antigen recognition, enhancement of the cells, like working out next-gen manufacturing through gene editing versus using viruses and being able to put more things reliably into cells. That's one bucket.
Yeah.
We just talk about Moonlight Bio sort of to fully sort of go with that thesis of how do we sort of learn from T-cell malignancies and build a better T-cell therapy with enhancements. That's sort of one bucket of how do you build a better T-cell. And then Dispatch is also going in these arenas, but one of the key things about Dispatch is it's a combination therapy. And this is another part of the PiSeq network, right?
Yeah.
The PiSeq network was working with a company that had an evolved virus that can infect epithelial malignancies, which are really greater than 90%. I mean, that's another thing to point out. Cell therapy, we've been really working in a small set of malignancies compared to the true landscape of solid tumors, which is 90% of the equation. So this particular virus has been evolved to infect many different solid malignancies. And what we've said is, well, can we use this virus now to fix the antigen problem? That's one of the problems, right? So every time, either at UCSF or in a company, the first question is like, what are we going to target the cell therapy to? And often, that's an extremely hard question to answer.
Sure.
Dispatch, in a lot of ways, collapses that problem down into like one answer, meaning that the virus will deliver the antigen that we want to target. And not only that, it turns out this virus can also accommodate other genes, meaning that this virus would infect the tumor, deliver an antigen, paint the tumor, and now we'll talk about the next step of that, with a particular antigen, but then it can also carry other genes, and those could be immune modulatory payloads, meaning additional immune stimulatory, let's say, proteins that would be produced to help prepare that tumor to where it could be better eradicated by a cell therapy. So that's the first piece of the therapy, mm-hmm. right? The virus. But then you pair it with the cell therapy that now has been programmed to recognize the antigen that you painted on the tumor. Then you can also add further enhancements to that T cell. So now you have two things, right? You have a virus that's helping you out by providing antigen. It's also preparing the tumor. And then you can come in with the cell therapy that can then hopefully persist and activate in a very specific way. So that's the landscape of hypotheses that we're going after in the different companies. But I think they're hitting on all the important aspects of, you know, getting cell therapies to be the next pillar of medicine. Like yeah. they will become the next pillar of medicine if we solve all these problems. And it can all be done by one entity, especially from the beginning.
Right. That makes a huge amount of sense. So, you know, we've got a lot of young scientists that are out there, postdocs and young professors that are listening in. Could you, you know, maybe give some advice on how you go from these ideas into commercialization and really from your journey from lab to startups? How do you take these ideas forward?
So I guess it's been about a decade that I've been doing this, a little bit longer. If we're just talking about academic scientists that are developing right. in an institution like UCSF, and maybe even one that isn't so much like UCSF because it's a medical institution, which is sure. different than other places, I think you have to decide like how much time you want to spend with this. Because what I found is that there are certain folks that they build a technology and then they want someone else to take it to the next step and sort of push it out of this setting at an earlier stage, and then someone else takes responsibility for it.
Yeah.
My desire is to say, like, let's figure out how to best shepherd this technology to the clinic. And mm-hmm. what I think can help with that is a lot of de-risking before you build the company.
Sure.
So if you're able to do it, and I think the PiSE network helps us do it because we have the right collaborators, we have the right funding that can come very quickly in order to do all the work to say, all right, we built the prototype of what the clinical product looks like, but what are the set of value inflection experiments that are required to say, it's not ready for prime time fully, but we have a ton of conviction that this yeah. is going to be meaningful clinically. Mm-hmm. So my belief is that you should spend a lot of time on that. And also it means that you should be seeking out advice. So for me, I'm talking to all the people that I know should be involved early on, meaning
right.
folks within PiSE and the network that have seen sort of many things in the clinic and gone through the ups and downs of cell therapy. Right. There is talking to the venture capitalists, because often you're funding these capital intensive mm-hmm. companies through that network of folks, and you want to find the right partners that are going to help you make good decisions and shepherd it. And the other thing is, you don't want people that are short-term thinkers. You want people that are going to be on the journey for 5, 7, 10 years, because that's sort of the time for development of
sure.
most therapies. So I think all of those things, it's important to, not everybody's going to want to be involved in all those processes, but
yeah.
need to sort of interact with those different networks to know how to leverage them in the right way to get to a place where you have conviction that it's worth taking out, building a company around it, and it's going to have meaningful impact in patients. And for me, it just turns out that I sort of love that mix of things. I think over time, getting to a good paper, there's satisfaction there, but taking it to the next step is like especially gratifying. And it's not an individual thing. It takes so many yeah. people along
yeah.
that path. Mm-hmm. You just accumulate really awesome colleagues that
oh, yeah.
Want to work with you.
Cole, you've had some incredible mentors through the years, both at UT Southwestern, at UCSF. Maybe you could talk a little bit about what they've taught you, what you've learned from them, and how you've taken that forward to mentor your own students.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, I have a whole network of mentors at this point, and then both in time and then currently, I guess. And I'll start with, I've talked about Wendell, who was my postdoc mentor, and sort of my transition and from sort of basic immunology to synthetic biology and cell therapy. And what he taught me a lot is like, how do you pick scientific problems? I care a lot about how we present our work to other people. Like, it turns out, like, most likely you should find a way to sort of put your science together to where you can bring it to the masses. And a lot of people should understand why it's important. And, you know, just given what's happening in the world today, like, we should, as scientists, be really good at that. There's only so much you can complain about your research as far as, like, people just don't get it. It's like, the onus on you is to show that why something is important. And we educate through giving talks, but and then also how we put together papers are meant to educate people and why they should care, and not just the 10 people that do what you do. Potentially there are a lot of people in the PiSEE network, so people like Carl June, Phil Greenberg, Crystal Makel, all these folks that have seen the ups and downs of cell therapy, understanding how to get through these you know, peaks and troughs. And I would say, like, in biotech right now, we're sort of in a trough, and sentiment is hard. And like, people having those mentors that help us get through, like younger folks like me that are going through this, has been incredibly important. And I think learning from them, I transfer all this sort of knowledge to the people that work under me, and it helps me stay even keeled and able to make decisions that help progress people's careers. And then I would say the third mentor sort of category is some of the folks more in company development. Brian Roberts of Venrock, who I think is an amazing investor and company builder. I think there's ways to build companies with high integrity and high fidelity. Yeah. And we should think about the long term. How do we make sure to do right by the technology, bring it to patients? There can be all these times when you're talking about sort of building big companies that can be worth a lot of money, to have high integrity, truth seeking. What's the balance of like excitement and hype versus like reality, and making sure that you are delivering on promises? Someone like Brian is that way. And then, honestly, I would also like to just mention Sean. I've known him now for about 8-9 years. And I really appreciate people that come into an arena that they haven't sort of traditionally been part of, and taking so much time and effort to really integrate, learn what's happening, and be able to make such substantive sort of impact and go along the journey, not only with us as academics, but being part of, he's part of the boards of my companies. He helps make really good strategic decisions. So all of those folks have helped shape me. And I think what you get when you come to my lab is that you get a smattering of all these different perspectives. And what I hope is that people see that there's different places to be super impactful in science, and there's not one thing. And what I hope is that I can provide an opportunity for people to go along those different paths and figure out what is right for them. So I think that's what the sort of diversity of thought has led to.
You know, speaking of teams, you know, you've took the position as PiSEE Center Director in UCSF in just a couple years ago, 2023. And you've been leading a team really of well-established investigators, some really fantastic people in the CAR-T space, the engineering space, checkpoint space. What's your strategic vision for the center? I know each of the PiSEE network centers has really the fingerprint of their center director. So when you're thinking about the center and the direction you want to go, what is that vision that you want to push forward?
I think we're about, 9 years into PiSEE at this point. And I think what we've learned about UCSF over that initial phase is that we're especially good at building new technologies that we think are viable and can be brought to the clinic and make a difference. And it's somewhat focused on cell therapies. Although, you know, we are understanding mechanisms of immunotherapy in general as well. But that's where my strategic vision is. Like, how do I make sure that we have longevity in the sense that we're constantly building new technologies that are clinically viable to make impact in patients?
Yeah.
And we may not do it all here at UCSF, but we're building pieces of the puzzle that we can do something similar to what happened with Arsenal, where we can go out to the network and find the other pieces of the puzzle to build clinical product.
Absolutely.
So what does that mean? It's, I would say, the first phase of PICE here. We stimulate collaboration a lot with young investigators. I mean, we will do basic biology, obviously, and discovery matters, but I also want to have some understanding of a path to building new therapeutics.
Right.
Okay. And what that also means is that we want a pipeline to get to the clinic, not only in companies, but here. We have the backing of the institution with PICE and as well as other funds to bring cell therapies forward. So that's the other piece of the puzzle I want to sort of develop here with PICE UCSF. And that is, how do we go from prototype and papers to rapid clinical translation on the order of 2 years? So that I would say the crux of the issue in our field is that vast majority of trials, at least in cell therapy, I feel like we're still testing old technologies or things that could have been done 5 to 10 years ago.
Right.
Whereas like the pace of innovation is such that we are making innovations on the course of 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years. And the time to clinic has been probably on average much longer than that, five years.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I want to collapse that. I want to figure out how to build something here that allows us to get meaningful clinical data on a short time span, because I think it's increasingly the case that preclinical data is not predictive.
Yeah.
That's what I would like to do with our network here, is build a pipeline to realize that vision.
Well, I'm sure that the overall PICE network is going to continue to be a, you know, important part of that. And we're obviously incredibly lucky to be able to support you and the work that's happening there. You know, I guess it hasn't always been easy though, right? I mean, you guys are doing the hard work, but there's certainly been unexpected challenges, twists and turns. Can you talk about any kind of challenges that you've run into in this journey, Cole, whether it's in the companies or even just the fundamental research things that you thought were going to work going in, but maybe taught you some other lessons along the way?
I mean, every day is a challenge, honestly, with what we do. I think what allows us to like break through barriers and maybe get past roadblocks, some of it is like the biology we can do at scale.
Yeah.
Like if I think about some of what we're doing now, you know, if we're trying to design something, we're not testing one iteration of it. We can now test thousands of iterations. So like we're failing all the time, but it just turns out
yeah,
some of the throughput allows us to get through that failure.
That's amazing.
But that's true for every step of the process, whether it be in a project here or in a company. Like we can fail iteratively at the early design of, let's say, some new technology like SynNotch or Sniper.
Sure.
And then we have to iterate, and any given week we could be putting out some fire. But then it's that next phase of understanding how it works in preclinical models. If things look good at all these different stages, then how do we manufacture this new thing, right? That requires something that doesn't exist. So any given month or year, I'm worried about different failure modes. It's the design of cell therapy, or like we know exactly what we wanted to put into a person, but we actually can't produce the product.
On that note, and thinking forward a few years even, or maybe at your rate, 6 months from now, if you look at all of cell therapy that's out there, we talked about some of the advances that you're going for now in terms of eliminating lymphodepletion, getting good persistence. What do you think a big challenge is that's in the cell therapy space now that you'd love to solve, you know, that you'd love to go after if you had to pick one?
Yeah, there's two major issues, and that is like, how do we actually get these to more patients? And there's people in our network like Justin Ekwem, who you who has been, also been on this podcast. There's the issue of, can we actually manufacture these cell therapies in the patient so we don't have to do the cumbersome manufacturing outside of the patient? Then the other thing that we've talked about here is the white space of solid tumors. Like, we still are struggling with that. And we are not there. I talked about issues of how we administer them with lymphodepletion. But we can fix all that, but if we don't get the efficacy level, then that's the problem. So we have to fix that. But the other thing is that if we can address all of those problems with cell therapy, like how we administer them, the cost of goods, not having lymphodepletion, PICE is all about cancer, but it also opens the landscape to autoimmunity, all these other places, right? People with less catastrophic disease don't want to get toxic preconditioning. Yeah, so I think that that's also sort of, the frontier of cell therapy as well. Like, if we solve some of the issues in solid tumors and make really potent therapies, and it becomes a lot easier to get them out to patients, then it opens up building cell therapies for many different types of diseases, and making true impact across many, many, many patients.
Now, this is absolutely huge. And that technology that you're developing and others in the network are out there developing have huge implications in the autoimmune disease space. So we're starting to see that. But it'd be great to, you know, to see this play out in transplantation and other fields where we could really see a big difference. We've got so many great people in the network itself, and you've run and collaborated with and trained with so many fantastic scientists that are out there. What is it that kind of drives you in terms of the getting up every day and kind of working on these projects? Is it the excitement of the lab? Is it the clinic? What's really the motivator behind you personally?
I think it's evolved during my career. I would say early on, I think most of us scientists, like, we like big, hairy problems. Like, you have to. Like, there's no short-term satisfaction. Like, you're working on things for years to get to inflection points.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, based on this conversation, what drives me now is turning discovery into actual impact, especially in patients. And I think another thing that happens with scientists in our space is, like, I accumulate so many interactions with people that are dealing with catastrophic cancers, pediatric cancers, friends that are going through that with their children, other adult friends, et cetera. And you just understand, like, the true toll of these diseases. And then that really, like, centers you. And even some of our work where people are putting in money to do rapid therapeutic development, then you're able to see how those diseases are, you know, impacting people's families and lives. And it's one thing to think about the population of patients without a face, I guess, right? That you're building a company and I'm doing prostate cancer, I'm doing XYZ. I think what has really grounded me is, like, there's so much urgency once you start to see it through personal interactions, like what people are going through. So that really drives me.
You know, and in the work you're doing, it sometimes feels, I'm sure, that it feels like there's something impactful right around the corner, you know, that can help somebody. Right. And when you, it's an incredible connection. It's so incredibly important. So, now this is, when you're not ab and transforming cell therapy, what is it that you do outside the network then, just to kind of unwind?
I'm fairly simple in the sense that all of us within the PICE network, you guys that run this incredible program, like, we work a lot, like, as scientists. I mean, we've talked about the range of stuff that is involved with my job. So I also have young kids. Like, I want to spend time. The other thing that seeing people going through cancer and these diseases, you understand, like, you can work hard and do all these things, but you better sort of experience life. So I spend time traveling with my family, which is extremely important to me. Like, seeing life through our kids' eyes is, I think, pretty special and helps sort of motivate and, you know, push you in your career. For me, I do anything from running as well. Like I like physical activities. I play some, I enjoy golf, and it's something I've done since I was quite young, which could have been a different profession for me in a different world. But my biggest thing is I want to make sure that I not only accomplish all these things in the career and push it forward, but also take the time to enjoy life, especially with my family, which
that's phenomenal. That's great. So one of the things I ask everybody is exactly what you touched on. And that is, if you weren't a scientist, what does he think you'd be doing? If you weren't doing this and, you know, engineering cells and taking things forward, what are the, you know, what pursuit would you be going after?
What I take into science is I actually think there's a lot of art in science, to be honest. And the reason I say that is we're often at the edge of the unknown, trying to sort of figure things out when there's not a lot of information. And if you look at artists or other professions, like, let's say, Michelin star chefs that are breaking boundaries, like people that are working at the boundaries, right? They're essentially going into what is effectively the unknown, right? They're putting themselves out there, and they have to figure a way through without having an example necessarily. And if I wasn't a scientist, I would probably be something in that realm, like in the arts or something like that.
Always pushing the boundaries.
Creative pursuits, I think, are something nice. That are especially gratifying. Doing something that's never been done before, I think, is exciting.
Well, this is what we love. So, Cole, I just want to thank you so much for this amazing conversation. Your work really does remind us that the greatest scientific leaps don't just come from understanding, but really trying to push the boundaries, like you just talked about. So with that, I'm Dr. John Conley. On behalf of the PiSE Network, I want to thank you for joining us for another journey from bench to fireside. Thanks, Cole. Appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
The difference between possible and impossible isn't always found in data or discovery. It begins with imagination, with the courage to see what doesn't yet exist and the vision to bring it to life. Dr. Cole Roybal and his team are doing just that. For patients, for families, for everyone waiting for a breakthrough. At PiSE, we don't just fund science, we drive it. We connect researchers, clinicians, and biotech pioneers to accelerate new discoveries and bring them to the people who need them most. But we can't do it alone. If you believe in the power of immunotherapy to change lives, help us push the next breakthrough forward. Visit parkerici.org to sign up for our newsletter, learn more, or join us in this mission. Thanks for listening. For PiSE, I'm Dr. Shane Corcoran, and this has been From Bench to Fireside.